It's On Health. I'm Allison Aubrey. Were you once a runner but stopped because you feared the wear and tear to your joints? Well, you might want to rethink the decision and put your sneakers back on. But first, a look at the HPV vaccine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have recommended that young girls around the age of 11 get the HPV vaccine to protect them against strains of the human papillomavirus that can cause cervical cancer. The idea is to get them vaccinated before they become sexually active and possibly infected with HPV. But some doctors are reluctant to administer the vaccine at such an early age. My colleague Brenda Wilson has this report on what doctors are telling their patients about the vaccine.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today. There's a new vaccine called HPV vaccine. One of the things I can tell you about it is it was designed to prevent a very serious illness, which is cervical cancer. But some questions have been raised about how well it does that.
That's how Dr. Arthur Lavin, a pediatrician and professor at Case Western University in Cincinnati, Ohio, typically begins a consultation with a parent of one of his patients. He tells them the CDC recommends the vaccine, but he also thinks parents should know his concerns.
One is, how long will it last? If the vaccine only lasts a few years, let's say 3 years, then a young adolescent girl, say an 11-year-old like your daughter, might not get much protection when she reaches the age of her peak of sexual activity, which hopefully will be more than 3 years from now.
It isn't yet clear how long the vaccine remains effective. He says, knowing that, parents might want to wait until the girl is older before she gets the vaccine. Dr. Jessica Kahn specializes in adolescent medicine at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital. She surveyed the attitudes of more than 1,000 doctors in Texas and found
physicians seem to be waiting. They're not all following the national recommendations to vaccinate 11 to 12-year-old girls, but instead some of them are opting to delay vaccination until girls are a little bit older.
Two-thirds of the physicians surveyed had no problem offering the vaccine to girls between the ages of 13 and 17. Other national studies had similar findings. But Kahn says physicians may not realize that the three-shot regimen has to be done before the girls are sexually active.
They don't understand how common HPV infection is in adolescents and how often adolescents acquire HPV within a few months of sexual initiation. And they may not understand that the vaccine is not effective in girls who are already infected with vaccine type HPVs at the time of vaccination.
And other doctors have even more serious worries. Dr. Diane Harper is a professor of family medicine and obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Harper was involved in reviewing the research conducted by Merck, but didn't see any problems with the vaccine until after it had been licensed.
I had concerns when I started to be contacted by parents whose children had neurologic problems.
She thinks parents and young women should weigh the decision very carefully.
What I tell them is that the vaccine is proven effective, and I tell them that for most women it is safe, that there are real risks associated with it, and that there have been some young women, a very small number, that have died. And so they need to understand that it's not a risk-free vaccine.
The CDC has reports of at least two deaths related to neurological events not usually found in young girls that are now being investigated but have not yet been linked to the vaccine. Dr. Jessica Kahn says the number one reason pediatricians gave for not vaccinating the girls is that the parents wouldn't let them.
We found that 60% of the physicians said that parents had refused the vaccine because of negative media reports. And I think this is really unfortunate because all the evidence that we have so far has shown that this vaccine is safe.
Some doctors are depending on the girls having another option for preventing cervical cancer, regular pap smears for HPV, which they will still have to do even with the vaccine because it doesn't protect against all strains of HPV. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
I've gotten to that age where everyone seems to have a creaky knee or a little ache or pain here or there. Some people are even talking about hanging up their running shoes. So I wanted to look into the evidence of pounding and arthritis. What I learned is that most of the recent studies suggest that moderately intense weight-bearing exercises, including long-distance running, don't seem to increase the risk of arthritis. I reached physician Harvey Simon. He's about 67 right now, but he told me back in college he earned the ironic nickname Gazelle, thanks to his running style.
I'm reasonably lean, but I'm uncoordinated and clumsy. My running stride is something awful to look at. But I haven't missed a day of running since October 30th, 1978.
After clocking a little over 100,000 miles in these years, Simon says his knees and hips are no worse for the wear.
I may be lucky, I may be genetically gifted in that way, but my joints are fine.
So is Harvey Simon an anomaly? Isn't all that pounding bound to do some damage? Consider this, and these are figures Simon quotes. Every time a runner strikes the ground, he or she applies 8 times their body weight to the joints. So if you take a 150-pound person, each stride will impose a load of about 1,200 pounds to the body.
And that goes from the foot to the knee to the hip to the spine, etc.
And that's a lot of weight.
Over the course of a mile, that's tons and tons of impact. So it's an understandable thing that people suspect that that might be harmful to joints.
But what the most recent studies are showing is that for many people, it's not harmful. In a new analysis for Harvard Men's Health Watch, Simon cites 3 different lines of evidence. In one long-term study, which included about 1,200 residents of the town of Framingham, Massachusetts, researchers looked for a correlation between arthritis and exercise. But what they found?
People who are physically active were no more likely to develop symptoms of arthritis or x-ray evidence of arthritis than people who were sedentary.
And then there's a study from Stanford University that tracked a group of long-distance runners for 20 years. Researchers compared their health to others of similar age who did less exercise. Stanford's Eliza Chakravarti says they expected to find a lot more problems in the runners' knees, but it turns out they had healthier joints at the end of the study.
It does sort of negate the idea that running is universally bad on the knees.
And the other studies negate the idea that moderately intense exercise, including running, leads to a higher risk of arthritis. Stephen Blair is an exercise scientist at the University of South Carolina. He says there are some clear risk factors for osteoarthritis that are related to physical activity.
The primary determinant or the primary predictor of joint injury is a previous injury. You know, you may have damaged something when you were a kid, let's say, that then causes you trouble later on.
If you suffer an injury in a shoulder or knee, you're 2 to 5 times more likely to develop arthritis in that joint. Other risk factors include being overweight, age, or alignment problems. Say if one leg is shorter than the other, this can put unusual stress on the joints. Blair says there are all sorts of individual exceptions, and he says it's important for everyone to be careful and not overdo it. But increasingly, he says, the studies are reminding us that the joints were made for moving. For more on that study from Stanford University with those long-distance runners, we reached back out to Eliza Chakravarti of Stanford Medical School. She joined us by phone from Palo Alto.
We started this study in 1984, and we had about 500 people who were members of a nationwide running club. So they were regular runners, and they ran about 5 hours a week on average.
So not marathoners per se, but definitely putting in some time.
Yes, definitely committed runners. And we compared them to about 500 people who weren't members of the running club. Some did do some exercise, but on average, they exercised about 90 minutes a week.
So they were not couch potatoes?
They weren't couch potatoes, and they were actually quite healthy people otherwise. They were, had similar measures of very few of them were overweight, very few of them were smokers. They all had at least a college education. So we were trying to rule out or eliminate out other differences that may be between runners and non-runners, such as obesity and smoking and things like that.
I see. And what did you find when you looked at the running group? Were they in worse shape when they got into their 70s and 80s for having put in all that pounding?
No. In fact, when we had started the study, we had hypothesized that they would have improved benefits in cardiovascular disease, fewer heart attacks and strokes and things like that. We thought that the payoff or the consequence may be more problems with arthritis of the knees because of all the pounding. And so we were surprised to find that after 21 years, not only did the runners have better outcomes as far as cardiovascular deaths, where they had fewer deaths overall and also fewer deaths from cardiovascular disease, but they also had fewer deaths from all different causes, including cancer, neurologic diseases, infections, and pneumonia, and things like that.
And this was over the group that the matched group were, that were in somewhat good health but were not the long-distance runners.
Exactly. This was compared to the group of relatively healthy people who were not long-term runners.
So a lot of folks might be a bit incredulous here, hearing about these findings. Everyone knows someone who is a runner and has got a creaky knee or starting to feel a bit of arthritis. You hear people talking about hanging up their running shoes and moving to a lower impact exercise. Do you think that you can generalize these findings from these from this running group set to, you know, the everyday person out there just trying to stay fit by running?
Well, I think we can generalize a little bit. There is a certain sense in which this was a select group of runners. So this was already a group of people who did not, who enjoyed running, kept running, so did not have serious limiting injuries. But what we really believe is happening is that this result can probably be generalized to all different forms of routine vigorous exercise, so cycling or swimming or aerobic dance or tennis or vigorous walking. And we think the benefits are really from the vigorous exercise rather than running as a specific exercise per se. Because in the 80s, running was becoming such a popular form of exercise, this was a nice group to study. But we do believe that the results are generalizable.
And what do we know about any genetic links here between, you know, arthritis and joint health? I'm wondering if because you began studying runners who were already in their 50s and 60s, if they weren't a unique group that perhaps were part of this lucky running gene pool that were able to still be running injury-free into their 50s and 60s, by that age, some people have already left it behind.
That's correct. But we do have somewhat of a select group, but most of the people in the running group had been running for 10 or more years. We also looked at the compared how many subjects in each group had reported having knee injuries in the past.
Did you find that the people who'd had injuries then went on to have more arthritis?
Well, we weren't able to do those particular types of analyses, or we didn't do those particular type analyses yet, but we did find that people who were in the runner's club had a higher percentage of previous knee injury than the people in the control group.
Now, do you think that your findings overall turn the perception that running is hard on the joints and is something that inevitably people have to give up? Do you think that might turn this perception on its head a bit?
Well, it's hard to say. I think it does support, it does sort of negate the idea that running is universally bad on the knees. But whether or not we can say for any particular individual that they may have more problems with their knees by running, it's hard to tell. Things that we couldn't look at in our study were the mechanics, so alignment of the knees, or alignment of the feet, whether people were flat-footed or not, or whether people had ligament disorders or mechanical disorders that we know can accelerate arthritis of the knees.
Now, I've interviewed a few researchers who say that given your study and other similar studies finding that exercise is not linked with an increase in osteoarthritis, I've had a few people say to me, you know, look, the idea that osteoarthritis, which is just sort of the general type of arthritis people get as they age, this notion that it's the wear and tear variety of arthritis that it gets worse as we pound our joints or use them more, that this is becoming sort of outdated thinking. Would you agree?
I think so. I think that there's a lot more going on to osteoarthritis. And in fact, in our study, when we looked at the development of osteoarthritis over time, we certainly expected that the runners would have much more osteoarthritis and many more knee replacements and things like that. And we found that there was no difference, and that, in fact, although it wasn't statistically significant because we had small numbers of people who actually were able to get x-rays throughout the study, that the people in the control group actually had more severe osteoarthritis and had had more knee replacements than people in the runner's club.
So does this finding leave you in the situation of perhaps suggesting to your patients, look, if you've got a little bit of osteoarthritis, you know, sort of exercise through it? Or what? Where does it lead you as a clinician in terms of advising your patients?
Absolutely. I'm a very strong advocate of exercise, particularly in people who have mild osteoarthritis or even have some aches and pains. The benefits we know that exercise can have on the knees is the more the quadriceps are strengthened, it actually supports the knees. In addition, cartilage, which is the cushion in the knees and in the joints, doesn't have its own blood vessels. So the way that it gets nutrients is actually by moving the knees, and so that the nutrients come in and out sort of like if you were squeezing a sponge. And so I am a very strong advocate of exercise in everyone, but particularly in people who have some early arthritis of the knees. This doesn't mean that I'm expecting everyone to go out and become a marathon runner. I think any form of exercise that gets people moving, gets their heart rate up, and that they enjoy.
Eliza Chakravarti is a rheumatologist at the Stanford Medical School. That's all for this week's On Health. If you'd like to contact us, you can write to us at NPR Health, one word, at npr.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Allison Aubrey.